The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Salve, citizens, and welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Jason Freeman. I'm a producer and editor here in the Author Events Office, and tonight it's my great pleasure to introduce Mary Beard, acclaimed by The Guardian as a national treasure and easily the world's most famous classicist. Mary Beard radiates authority and expertise in guiding her readers through the world of ancient Roman civilization. She is a professor at the University of Cambridge, a fellow of Newnham College, and a Royal Academy of the Arts professor of ancient literature. Some of her seminal works include Rome in the Late Republic, The Parthenon, The Fires of Vesuvius, and SPQR, A History of Ancient Rome, a favorite book of mine. She is also the classics editor of the Times Literary Supplement, where her column, A Dawn's Life, is regularly published. A frequent contributor to the New York Review of Books, she has written and presented several BBC historical documentaries. Her new book is called 12 Caesars, Images of Power from the Ancient World to the Modern. In it, she explores the ways in which images of Roman emperors have influenced artists and thinkers for more than 2,000 years. A review in The New Yorker reads, "This thoroughgoing survey examines the relationship between ancient imperial imagery and the modern visual imagination, with handsome illustrations of coins, canvases, frescoes, and teacups. Beard brings the prestige and power of these emperors' half-invented faces into tighter focus." And Margaret Atwood, in one of my favorite recent blurbs, proclaims, "What better escape from the woes of our present day than rolling around in the intrigues of the Roman Empire? Naughty Caesars! Pictures, too. Avidly, I plunge in." Tonight's author will be in conversation with Michael Kolakowski, the head of the History Department and the Edwin Earl Sparks Professor of History and Classics at Pennsylvania State University. He is the author of Rome's Gothic Wars, Late Roman Spain and Its Cities, The Triumph of Empire, and The Tragedy of Empire. He has appeared in several History Channel documentaries, has published numerous academic articles, and is a regular contributor to the London Review of Books and the Wall Street Journal. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Mary Beard and Michael Kolakowski to the Free Library.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for having us. It's a rare honor to be on the stage with Mary and to talk about these sorts of people that we're seeing on the screen up here now, the Roman emperors, the 12 Caesars. And I thought we might just as well get straight into it. And give people sort of value for money, and ask why the number 12, Mary?
Why the 12 Caesars? Well, look, there were more than 12 Roman emperors. There was hundreds of Roman emperors between, actually, 44 BC, when Julius Caesar became the sort of first Roman emperor, and let's say in the East, the 15th century, when finally the Byzantine Empire, which was the Roman Empire, fell. But the ones that have always hit home are the first 12. And they do that because they were the subject of a series of biographies by Suetonius, an avid biographer of the second century CE, who wrote a series of biographies of emperors from Julius Caesar, assassinated 44, to Domitian, assassinated 96 CE. Most of them were assassinated, not quite all, but most. And so they have become the emperors that we kind of think of as a set. Right? There's two dynasties of them. There's a civil war in between. They're not all the same, but they kind of produce the canonical set of 12 emperors, and they conveniently match all the other things that come in 12s,
yes,
in the world, you know, like apostles or, yeah, loaves of bread or whatever. They become how you think about Roman emperors. There's plenty more, there's plenty later. There are all sorts of, you know, question marks over them. But if you say emperors to somebody in the 18th century, what they think of first is this lot.
And so it makes it a good way to sort of, a way to focalize thinking about the idea of emperorship in general, really.
Yeah, I mean, it gives you two dynasties, each of which end badly. Gives you civil war. It kind of gives you every ramification. If you go through the stories of these guys, it gives you every ramification of power, corruption, autocracy, murder, and occasional flashes of good government.
Right. So shall we get started with the first?
Well, we've put some slides together. Yeah. We won't look at them all. But I wanted to start with this because the point of the book, taking off from the 12 Caesars, is, I suppose the main point is to try to convince readers that Roman emperors in the visual arts are not boring. I mean, I think that we do have a vision of an image of a Roman emperor, which is almost always a white marble bust. Each of them looks much like every other. Michael and I have been talking before coming on stage. In some ways, this book is an attempt to get people to look at the things that they normally walk past in museums. And I promise you, because I've sat for hours looking, most people walk past images of Roman emperors. They think that they're all the same. They're rather bland, conservative, white, middle-aged images of power. And so this is just what you see on the screen now. It's just a taster of 9 different images of Roman emperors, that some of which are kind of different from what people would imagine. My favourite, I have to say, now, is this going to be... If this turns everything off, I'm sorry. I'm hoping it's the pointer. Yes,
yeah,
it is.
Perfect.
Yeah, it is. My favourite is my local microbrewery in Cambridge, who has a series of Roman emperor beers. It is Cambridge, you know, it's a very learned audience. And this is their Augustus beer. This is the beer mat for Augustus. I tell you, Augustus is a very rotund, authoritative beer, right? And each of the beers are kind of coded to the Suetonian characteristics of the emperor concerned. So Caligula is an extremely fizzy, naughty beer.
How does Vitellius come off?
Do you know, I think they haven't done Vitellius. They perhaps haven't done all the 12. They've done Nero. Nero is a dastardly beer, you know, only for real men, you know.
10.5% alcohol.
It's hugely intoxicating. But, in part, this is a joke, and they did it as a joke. Come on, but partly it's kind of just reminding us that, I mean, not only do we often sort of write the emperors off as being kind of sort of rather bland wallpaper that, you know, and you can't actually tell one from the other, and it's, you know, come on, let's go to see something more interesting. But they're still all around us. They still sort of mean something. You know, I'm sure most of you in the audience are real experts, but even the ones of you that aren't real experts still got the joke about Caligula being, you know, a fizzy, naughty little beer, and Nero being a 10.5 alcohol. And so it's like, the book really is an attempt to open our eyes, and that means me, you know, because when I say people tend to walk past images of Roman emperors in museums, I mean, I tend to walk past. And it was really, I partly did this book in order to stop myself walking past. But we're also, we still use those images. And they're also, they never have been, they're multicolored, they're different, they include women as well. And this is another of my favorites, just happens to be near me. I mean, this is about a meter high image of Caligula. I think it's Caligula. They all look the same. Shh, don't say. done by a celebrity firm of ceramicists in late 19th century Italy in this, I'm going to say glorious technicolor, extremely vulgar colors. I mean, you know, whoever did this, what they were doing it for, God only knows. But what you see is that those kind of rather austere, not very interesting marble busts are only one part of the images of Roman emperors that we still see around us, all over the place. I mean, and I say women as well, here's Aubrey Beardsley in the early 20th century, using the image of imperial women as ways of talking about sexual deviance, perversion, excess. You know, they're always, and they always have been, on hand to discuss things.
And she looks terribly angry.
She looks jolly angry. And it's supposedly, well, we think it's Messalina, the wife of Claudius, coming home from the brothel, because the stories went that Messalina, these are deeply misogynistic stories, actually, and do not believe a word of what I'm about to say, but the story went that Messalina had this, you know, grumpy old husband, Claudius, and she, on one occasion, challenged the prostitutes of Rome to a competition to see who could sleep with more men in a 24-hour period. And surprise, surprise, the amateur Messalina beat the professionals and won the, you know, this is, you know. Now, I'm telling that with two kind of hearty and amused intonation. You know, this is about misogyny, sexual distrust, woman-hating. But Aubrey Beardsley, not entirely coincidentally, picks it up in the early 20th century to think about the sexuality of the new woman in the early 20th century.
Absolutely. And it's, of course, also the Roman discourse is not just misogynistic, but it's also very ableist because, of course, she's off and away in the brothels, in part because her husband Claudius is presented as being enfeebled and disabled. So it's a sort of...
I mean, every modern crime that you want, you can find exemplified in Suetonius.
Yes.
And, you know, it is very interesting. Claudius himself has got off rather lightly in modern literature, partly because of Robert Graves, I, Claudius, even more so, I think, because of the BBC, HBO 1970s, 80s series of I, Claudius, which recreated Claudius as a slightly kind of bumbling old chap who was a bit academic and was driven to distraction by people like Messalina. In fact, he was a murderous old bastard, actually.
Absolutely, yeah.
He killed more men than Nero did, but he somehow got away with it.
Well, he'd been waiting a long time, of course. So.
He'd been waiting, yes.
So should we talk about Caesar, then?
Yeah, well, I think this is the week in which we have celebrated the anniversary of the assassination of Julius Caesar. Ides of March, 15th of March, earlier this week, was the 2000-and-somethingth anniversary, you can count it, Michael, of the assassination of Caesar. And in a way, Caesar is sort of not an emperor. He isn't, you know, he's on the cusp between being an old Republican politician and being a new emperor. But for me, he's a brilliant, absolutely brilliant example of quite how difficult it is, even with this lineup you see here of marble busts of different colours. There's a secret that in most cases we don't know who they are. Now, I think the other thing that I sort of want to say, I hope people go away with, is that you go to an art museum and you see this lineup of busts which you're going to walk past. But underneath every one, there's going to be a name. You know, it's going to say Augustus, Vitellius, Julius Caesar, Domitian, or whatever. Now, the reason for those names is really that art historical curators hate putting, they just hate putting on labels, unknown Roman, right? But mostly, unknown Roman is what these people are. But you know, we don't want to see labels which say unknown Roman, and they don't want to write labels that say unknown Roman. And there's been a huge, absolutely enormous pressure. Some of it probably not wrong, I'm sounding too sceptical, to name these ancient busts. And actually, the only evidence we have that is at all, you know, and even then it's fragile, but that is at all authoritative for what Julius Caesar actually looked like is this coin done just before he was assassinated over here. Because it's got his name on it. You know, ancient busts are not found with their names on. If what you think is an ancient bust has got its name on, it's a forgery, right? It was a basic rule of thumb.
So here the only thing it's got going for it is the lines of the neck, no? Or?
Well, you got this image, and one of the things people pick out is the lines of the neck. I tend to pick out the laurel wreath at the top. I'm not quite sure if I can land on the laurel wreath, but it's around here. Because one of the stories, and I tell you this because there is a resonance with your last president, that Julius Caesar was terribly anxious, according to Suetonius, about going bald. And so when he was granted the ceremonial right to wear a laurel wreath on every state occasion, he thought, yippee, because first of all, it disguised his bald patch, but secondly, enabled him to do a comb over and insert the hair into the laurel wreath and disguise his baldness even further. I don't think that Mr. Trump knew that his comb-over had a history of well over 2,000 years. Mr. President Trump, President Caesar and President Trump. Trump has got the same, I have to say, men have had for many centuries. So you've got the best we can do. How far this is really like what Caesar looks like, God only knows. I mean, you know, I look at the coins of Queen Elizabeth II. And they're a bit like her, but she sure doesn't look 95 on our British coins. So there's a kind of, there's an engagement between her image and the coin.
One of the things I like the most about what you do with Caesar, the Caesar chapter, is that you sort of bring out why it's so unlikely for there to have been hundreds of busts of Caesar.
Yes. Because he was killed too quickly. You know, Caesar was in Rome for about 6 months, actually. I mean, he was always going off. He was fighting the Civil War. He wasn't there very often. He clearly had great plans to put out busts of himself everywhere. He clearly saw the propaganda purpose of the marble image that nobody had seen before in Rome. But he didn't have any time to do it. And so what you've got here is three images that have, over the years, been lined up with this one. And, you know, this is the kind of... this is what you're trying to play snap to. Mm-hmm. The most famous one in the last 200 years is this guy who looks for all the world like Julius Caesar, you know, slightly sinister and balding. And certainly if you go back to any biography of Julius Caesar in the early 20th century, you know, that's what's on the front cover, that one. In fact, he was made in about 1800. And of course, he looks like what we think Julius Caesar looked like because he was made to look like what we think Julius Caesar looked like. This I put on because it's Michael's favourite.
It's really pretty. The sort of the horrible eyes gazing out at you are sort of my, sort of I find it sinister, and of course it's got the sort of, you know, the inscribed incised pupils, which can't possibly be Republican.
So it's, you know, God knows who made this. I mean, some people think it's about as new as this one. Other people think that it goes back to Julius Caesar's lifetime. Who the hell knows? It's in Berlin. People think it came from Egypt because it's in Egyptian stone. And, oh, then, fantasy. It might have been commissioned by Cleopatra herself. Whoa, right?
Yeah, no.
Put the spotlight on him, right? Yeah. This is the current favourite. And this is one that was dragged out of the River Rhone at Arles about 15, 20 years ago. Caesars have a kind of habit of being dragged out of rivers. One was, in the early 20th century, was dragged out of the River Hudson in New York. Quite how it got there.
Vikings.
Vikings, yes, it must have been the Vikings. Hey, that's a good idea, Michael. It was the Vikings. The one that came out of the Hudson is now in Sweden, and as I said, yes, he's been demoted to unknown Roman, I'm afraid. This guy came out of the River Rhone at Arles, and of course, what makes him Caesar? It's the liney neck, right? Yeah. Now, there is a terrible secret I have to share with you, that Caesar was not the only Roman to have a liney neck, right? Whether this is Caesar or not, I don't know. But he certainly become very famous in France. So famous, he has had two television programmes entirely devoted to him. He's had one exhibition entirely devoted to him, but even better, Caesar would have been so pleased. He's been on the French postage stamps as an image of Julius Caesar. So part of what I want to say, but, you know, don't get too disappointed because I'm going to recoup this in a minute, you know, is that actually we don't know, out of the sort of 60 or 70 busts that have been claimed to be Julius Caesar, some of them might be, but we don't know which they are, and the only way we do it is by matching up this coin with what they look like or what we think Caesar looks like.
Whereas with Caesar's adoptive son, we can be quite certain what his official portrait
is. I think that is true. Yes. And I think we ought to come on to him, because the good side of this is that, and really for the point of view of art history since the 16th century, is that sort of, as you see, we don't know whether these are really Caesar, but we do still have a kind of image of Caesar in our heads. You know, that, so we both know what Caesar looked like, sort of, and we don't. And so
you look like that.
You look like that. You know, that's from Asterix the Gaul, and nobody is going to have any doubt about who that is. So we have a kind of cultural image of Julius Caesar, but we can't really pin it down to actuality. There is Mussolini. You can't quite see Mussolini in the book, but he was a very great fan of Julius Caesar, and so he put a statue he thought was Julius Caesar in the Rome council chamber. However, Michael is right to say you do get some images of these 12 and later where even the images from antiquity, which are not named, you have a more than sporting chance of being able to identify them. And this is an image excavated in the 1870s, one of the most famous images of the Emperor Augustus, identified partly in the same way that Caesar is, because the head, it can be matched up closely to the coins of Augustus. I mean, that's always a risky business because, you know, a coin of a centimetre in two dimensions is very hard, actually.
But there are many more coins of Augustus, of course, than there are of Caesar, which helps, yeah. Rather.
Yes, yes, you've got more, you've got a kind of bigger pool of evidence. It was also found in the villa that belonged to Augustus's wife, Livia. And it looks as if this is kind of Livia's souvenir of her dead husband. I mean, you know, kind of imperial. You know, this is what imperial widows do. You know, they have statues like this. So I think this is now in the Vatican. It's got scenes from the life of career of Augustus on the breastplate. It's got a little Cupid down here reminding us that Augustus was supposed to be descended from the goddess Venus. I'm a pretty inveterate skeptic, but you'd have to be more of a skeptic than I am to say that that wasn't Augustus. But Michael wanted me to put these two images next to him because he hates them. Right?
I'm not a fan of the painter. Carved out of scented soap, painted with... What's the quip from about Alma Tadema?
They're very nice, but I'm a great fan, so I don't remember.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. No. The chocolate box. Yeah. Yes. So.
One of the things I try to do in the book is to meet the objections of Michael, right? Yeah.
And she has.
And partly that's, and he doesn't have this. He doesn't think they're boring, but. Another objection that I think a lot of people have to images of Roman emperors in Western art, and which I have in my time shared, is that you get something like this, and then you have a kind of slightly romanticising late 19th century painter making a hell of a lot of money out of doing rather cheesy images of Roman emperors, which aren't really worth very much scrutiny, actually. You know, that this was all very nice in its representation of the tiger skin and the marble, but it was a bit second rate. Right? And I don't want to get us bogged down here, because otherwise no. Michael and I will stay here forever arguing about this, but... we have two pictures here, which you can see were painted just after this was discovered by Dutch-British painter Lawrence Alma Tadema. And they both feature the sculpture in their two images. And one is called An Audience at Agrippa's, and the other is called After the Audience. And Agrippa is this guy here, who here is coming down to meet the people, and there is going back upstairs after he's met the people. And Agrippa was Augustus's right-hand man. Augustus is the guy who, in a sense, after Julius Caesar's a kind of brief spell in power, Augustus is the guy who essentially establishes an imperial image like this and establishes the basic politics of one-man rule at Rome, which is going to last for centuries and centuries. He is the founder of the empire. And we know that this guy Agrippa is his sort of... his Augustus wasn't a great general. Agrippa is his military man, but, you know, his wise counsellor, who is keeping Augustus on the straight and narrow. And here we've got a load of people who are wanting to put requests to Agrippa, and there is Agrippa going back. They've gone after they put their requests. I can see why you think it's chocolate boxy, but I think that it is where you start to see some of the politics of these 19th century images. I mean, I think here you've got the tiger skin is the giveaway for me. The tiger skin is saying, actually, this is a luxurious, slightly excessive, almost orientalizing empire. And here is this small grey character who is the éminence grise behind the Augustan regime, the guy who never really comes to the limelight, but is sort of in power, being put against the most famous statue of the most famous emperor. And what are they going to do with the tiger skin? Well, actually, they all want a favour. Everybody in the Roman world wants a favour from the emperor. And they put out the presents they brought, the bribes, on the tiger skin. And the poor old petitioners have gone away. We don't know what happens. And Agrippa is so bloody highfalutinly mighty, he just leaves the stuff on the tiger skin and goes back. And so I think that these are quite clever paintings, saying, who's in control here? Is it this sort of slightly shadowy figure who can't even be bothered to pick up the silver dish that someone's left for him? No, this is modelled on a really famous bit of Roman silver. And he's just got to leave the slaves to take it. And he's gone back upstairs. And here, meanwhile, you've got this statue. Who's in control? I think that's what Al-Mutadhim is saying. So I think he's doing more than chocolate box. But that was my lesson to you, Mudd.
Thank you very much. I'd already learned it.
he said to me in an email, he said, we'll put some of those awful Al-Mutadhims in. And I thought, oh. Yeah. Perhaps
we should move on.
Perhaps we better move on.
Ah, yes, okay. Well, it's a Pittsburgh question, not a Philly question, but you end with Andy Warhol and the Grimani Vitellius, and so I thought I must ask you to talk about Warhol, because right. Native of our rival city.
Right. Well, I think that there is a kind of anti-hero of the book, and it's an emperor that is no longer a household name. I mean, Michael mentioned him earlier, Vitellius. Now, Vitellius was a decidedly nasty piece of work. He's one of Suetonius's 12. He rules for about 6 months after Nero has killed himself. He's defeated, nastily assassinated in civil war. Before the assassination, he has shown his true colours, which is voluptuary, glutton, sadist, sexual pervert, and paedophile, right? He is extremely nasty. He is represented on a coin here. And you might say, he's only in power 6 months. You know, how does he have time to put a coin out? Every emperor, basic rule, every emperor issues coinage because they've got to pay the army. So they've got to issue coins. By chance, in the early 16th century, this sculpture was dug up in Rome. And it was dug up by in excavations sponsored by a Catholic cardinal, Cardinal Grimani, and it's now known as the Grimani Vitellius. And when it was dug up, people started doing the kind of snap that they do with Caesar, and this was quickly identified. Same guy, you know, jowly, double chin, fat. Here is the perfect image of the gluttonous emperor. Now, what I have to say is it's not Vitellius at all. This is an unknown Roman. It's an unknown Roman we know that because there are certain techniques of the carving which make it extremely unlikely that it was done before the middle of the second century CE, century after Vitellius's death. Never mind, just like those Caesars and just like our kind of conventional images, that became the, underlined in italics, the image of the Emperor Vitellius between the 16th century and the 19th. And I have to say, now you've looked at him, try not to forget him, because that image as an image of imperial power gets everywhere, absolutely everywhere in art after the Renaissance. And I've been having kind of rather daring bets with people, which is to say, you know, if you buy my book and you really concentrate on getting that image in your head, I will bet you you cannot go to any major art museum in the Western world and not find a copy of him. And I'm so confident of that, I'd say that if you really go to an art museum and don't find him, I'll pay you back the cost of the book, right? Because I am so confident that he gets everywhere. And just to show you how he gets everywhere, here are some examples, just a handful of hundreds of how this image becomes absolutely top of the agenda in the way you saw the past, actually, in, as I say, between the 16th century and the 19th. This one, I actually found myself in an antique shop in Georgetown in Washington, D.C. I went in when I was doing the lectures that made the book, and I thought, blimey, it's Vitellius. I looked at it very hard, and I thought, it's not very nice actually. And the rather posh bloke who was running the antique shop came over, thinking, you know, mistaking me for someone who got a lot of money, and, you know, and said, "Can I help you?" And I said, "Well, I'm Vitellius, you know." I didn't confess; I hadn't got hope in hell of buying it. And he said, "It used to be owned by Andy Warhol, right?" There you are. It's got missed out of most of the authorised biographies of Warhol. Yes. It's Vitellius. But this one is really my... It's this blob, this late 19th century blob, which is now in the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. He's a much kind of smarter one from the National Gallery in D.C., and this one's in Minneapolis. And you look at it and you think, oh, here's a sweet little boy. What a sweetie. And he's doing his drawing lesson. What's he drawing? He's drawing a plaster cast, presumably, of the bust of Vitellius. And you think, God, he gets everywhere. You then think, is there something a bit odd about this? I mean, here is this sweet child, innocent, butter wouldn't melt in his mouth, and he is drawing carefully, he's copying the bust of one of the world's worst sexual perverts that there is. Is this artist actually saying, hang on a minute, something a bit, you know, we have to be careful about what we draw, because somebody has set this child to draw somebody who's not nice. And that kind of, I think, sets you off into seeing that this image is quite often doing a lot of work. And this is not a child drawing the bust of Augustus. This is a child drawing the bust of a monster. So what does that say about drawing and teaching?
And art in general.
And art.
Should we do Veronese?
Yeah. And then we better... And
yes.
And just, you know, for the final proof that he gets bloody everywhere, here we are in Venice, late 16th century. By this stage, that bust of Vitellius is well on display in town. And here's Veronese's picture, we now know as the Feast in the House of Levi. It's a controversial painting, vast. It was drawn for the back of a refectory of a religious order in Venice. Veronese painted it as a Last Supper, and the Catholic authorities got a bit anxious because there were certain unorthodox elements like dogs and Germans and things like this, and they challenged Veronese to say that this was an inappropriate image of the Last Supper. And Veronese was a clever old guy, and so he said, all right, fine, I'll just change the title then, right? And he called it the Feast in the House of Levi. But the figure that's interesting to me is this guy here. It's Jesus at the back. Here is the Last Supper or the feast going on. And here is what Veronese called really a butler or a carver. He's a waiter, head waiter. And he's got a very posh dressing gown, and he's looking across. If you look closely at him, we'll do in a minute, he's transfixed by the figure of Jesus. So in a way, it's a conversion scene. This guy, who's the waiter at the Last Supper, cannot take his eyes off the Messiah. And there he is, in large, and you see what he is? He's Vitellius. That Veronese has taken the physiognomy of the Grimani Vitellius and used it for his waiter. And you think, oh, well, it was a convenient model. Maybe it was a convenient model. But if you know the story of Vitellius, you see that he adds something, that what Veronese has shown you is not just a butler or a waiter being converted by the sight of the Messiah. He has shown you the most sadistic, wicked, immoral Roman emperor of the lot, who is here being used to give a face to the waiter. It's Vitellius who's being converted by Jesus. So I think it always adds something to recognize these guys. Now, happily, Vitellius is so recognizable that after a little scan of some of these pictures, I promise you, you can go right. I haven't checked your local art museum. I bloody bet there is one.
I think there probably is, yes. So talking of the local art museum, shall we do tapestries or should we do Agrippina, do you think?
Well, we're running. I think we've got to do tapestries.
Tapestries, probably.
Can I just apologise about the lack of women, right? the book, I did spend huge amounts of time, and we have managed to get some really good women in the book. But Michael,
somebody ask a question about it in the Q&A.
And you get a good answer, right, with slides.
But there are two really, if you've not read the book, there are two really good detective stories. One of them about a set of sort of silver serving dishes and another one about tapestries. And so if you know the art museum, there's a wonderful tapestry cycle here of the Emperor Constantine, which I've, in dozens of visits, never seen anybody looking at a single one of them. So I said to Mary, as with the mystery cycle that she's going to talk about, people do really walk by them.
Yeah. And as I said before, I think part of what this book is about is saying, please look at things you don't normally look at. And I include I learned to look at things that I don't usually look at from writing this book. And that's coins and medals, you know, plaster casts of marble busts, Renaissance silverware, and tapestries. And in some ways, the biggest eye-opener for me in writing the book was to discover tapestries. Because, as Michael says, if people walk past plaster casts or Roman busts, they sure walk past tapestries. And it's so easy for us to forget that in the Renaissance, the prime, most expensive, most privileged works of art were tapestries. and they cost a hell of a lot more than the panel painting that we now admire. And if you go through things, includes these, that you go through Renaissance inventories and you look for what is really expensive in a Renaissance palace, and it's the tapestries. Now, the second most expensive tapestry set in the Royal Collection in London, collected by Henry VIII, commissioned by Henry VIII, was a set of tapestries which in some way feature Julius Caesar. They weren't absolutely the most expensive. The most expensive was a set of tapestries of the life of the prophet Abraham. The second most featured Julius Caesar. Frustratingly, these tapestries don't actually survive, because what happens to tapestries is that the beautiful gold thread in them corrodes, gets dulls, sometimes comes out, and then they get put in the loft, and then they get thrown away. But what's, thanks to some extremely good detective work, largely by Thomas Campbell, who was at the Metropolitan Museum in New York, we have been able to recreate from copies, tapestry copies, what Henry VIII's tapestry set, really pricey set, looked like. And it certainly was. It did feature Julius Caesar. And here is a closely contemporary version, 16th century version, which, as you can see, it's now in the Vatican, features the assassination of Julius Caesar. It tells you at the top, this is the assassination of Julius Caesar. And for various technical reasons of the tapestry, we know that this is closely related by the same tapestry workshop as what Henry VIII had at Hampton Court Palace. And all kinds of other scenes in truly wonderful detective work have been identified across the world, actually, in these copies. And I decided I wanted to try to put them together. And here is one of them. And it's a tapestry which people have identified. They've got the Suetonius's Life of Julius Caesar out, and they've tied these tapestries together, and they've said, all right, can we now kind of identify the scenes? Sometimes the caption helps, sometimes it doesn't. And this scene is always identified, and there are about six versions of it. It's identified as Julius Caesar being warned by Spurinna, the soothsayer, that he should beware the Ides of March. If you remember in Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, it says, beware the Ides of March, and Caesar pays no attention. And he goes on to be murdered. This is supposed to be Spurinna, and this is supposed to be Julius Caesar. Perfectly plausible. There is, however, a problem. This is a woman, clearly, and Spurinna was a man. Confusingly, he ends in an A, but some Roman names end in an A, even if they're men, right? And actually, it's also kind of a very odd character. It's surrounded by little bats, and it's got a very funny hat on. When I looked at this first, I thought, hang on, that cannot possibly be Julius Caesar and Spurinna. That, I know what that is, I thought. That is a scene from Lucan's story of the Civil War, a great poem written in the reign of Nero, which does tell of Julius Caesar, but is a story of the appallingness of civil war, autocracy, and conflict. And a famous scene another character who's here goes to confront a witch called Erichtho in Thessaly and gets a nasty answer. This is not Spirinna. Spirinna would be horrified to be represented like this. This is the witch, Erichtho. Now, you don't have to worry. We're not going through all these. but here is another one, which is from another copy of the same scene, from the same series, which is identified as Caesar, somewhere up here, fighting a giant. You can look through Suetonius all you like, and there is no story of Julius Caesar fighting a giant. You then look at this, and you find that this actually, the more you look at it, I'm not sure if it's terribly clear, you might have to believe me, is that this is a pile of dead bodies. And there's a guy on top of the dead bodies, and there's fighting this guy here who's got a bow and arrow. What's that, I thought? Well, this is another scene from Lucan's great epic Pharsalia, when one of Caesar's men is so brave that he climbs on top of the bodies of his dead companions in order to fight one of Caesar's Civil War enemies, who eventually puts his eye out with his bow and arrow. Lucan tells this story as, as how ghastly bravery is in Civil War. So I looked at these series and I thought, this is not Suetonius's life of Julius Caesar in tapestry. This is Lucan's story of Civil War in tapestry. Now, you might think, okay, you stop at that point. Then you say, what do we know about Lucan's Civil War? Well, Lucan's Civil War is a complicated, now much admired epic. But one thing it certainly is an attack on one-man rule. It's not quite clear whose side Lucan, writing in the middle of the first century CE, is on, but he's certainly not on Caesar's side, and he's certainly not on the side of autocracy. This is where I think things get complicated and where I want to leave it. You say, okay, so Henry VIII spends more money than on almost anything else to commission a series of tapestries which illustrate a poem that attacks monarchy, and he puts them all around his palace. Now, one explanation of that might be a terrible commissioning mistake, right? They paid a hell of a lot of money. The tapestries arrived from Brussels. They opened the packing cases. Oh, bloody hell. What are we going to do now? His Majesty has just ended up with an attack on monarchy to put on the walls. That's possible. I think what I try to argue in the book is that there is something really interesting about some of these images in how they relate to monarchs and monarchy. And you actually find time and time again the autocrat, the dictator, the monarch choosing images which show you how corrupt monarchy is. Why they do that, I'm not sure. But there's something about the way that the image challenges the monarch to face up, in a sense, to the corruption of monarchy. So the monarchs, in the end, are looking at these images not as a legitimation, but as a warning. And there's plenty more examples of that. But I'm afraid this, as soon as you've seen that that is not Spirinna and Julius Caesar, but it is the witch offering terrible prophecies of what happens with monarchy, you know you're in trouble.
Absolutely, as Lucan was as well.
We're not going to go in what happened to Lucan. He actually was forced to suicide under Nero. Oh.
Perfect. Well, on that cheery note, I think please join me in thanking Mary further. And I think we've got some time for Q&A. I think I'll call on people from the audience, and then a microphone will be brought to you. So please raise your hand, and if you... Yeah, please, in the very back.
Thank you so much for coming to Philadelphia. It's so delightful to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I heard your Mellon lectures talking about Caesars, but I never heard you talk about the most handsome Caesar of them all, the Chiaramonte Caesar in the Vatican. What do you make of the Chiaramonte Caesar?
I have slightly oversimplified, for the sake of time, that what we're confronted with is the Holy Grail, which we never find, on the one hand, which is images of Caesar done during Caesar's lifetime. And those are totally elusive. On the other hand, we have our image of Caesar, a kind of conventionalized image of Caesar, which is a sort of composite. The truth is, and I think this is where the Chiaramonte Caesar comes in, later Roman artists themselves reinvented Caesar. Right. So you find, particularly actually in the early 2nd century AD, which is where I suspect the Chiaramonte Caesar should be dated, you find Roman artists and Roman emperors, particularly under Trajan and a bit later under Hadrian, they are reconstructing an image of Caesar too. So the kind of the Chinese boxes here are not just, I mean, it's not just a standoff between, as I was slightly implying, between an image of Caesar done during his lifetime and our version of that, but actually the Romans too were constructing, partly on the basis of Suetonius, partly on the basis of coins, partly on the basis of their own imaginary of what Caesar looked like. They, hundreds of years after Caesar's assassination, they too were doing it. And most of the ones that are most Caesar-like, with the Chiaramonte would be one, are almost certainly 2nd century, also Roman versions, recapturing Caesar as, in a sense, the origin of Roman autocracy, a very flawed origin of Roman autocracy, because, you know, Roman autocracy ends with, you know, begins with a guy who's assassinated. So I think that the label, in a way, on the Chiaramonte Caesar is not wrong, but I don't think it's Caesar in a kind of sense of an authentic Caesar.
Yes, thank you. 2 points. I think you maybe should send a copy of your book to Vladimir Putin. And hope he reads the last chapter. Another note, you mentioned there was somebody who had written a number of biographies of all these Caesars. Now, are the original transcripts or the manuscripts available, or are you relying on copies and translations and possibly adulterated versions of that over the period? And how do you determine what is the truth?
I think that other people have sent some of have sent messages to Putin about Caesar. The difficulty in answering the second part of your question is that in some ways it requires, you're hitting the nail on the head for the whole of classical scholarship for the last 500 years. Because a huge part of classical scholarship is working out what the authors that we have actually wrote. Now, I think I've caught myself out here on several times. Classicists have a very, very bad shorthand that they say, we still have the Lives written by Suetonius, or we still have the letters of Cicero, or the letters of Pliny, or we still have Virgil's Aeneid. And that shorthand makes it look as if we have the manuscript copy. They don't mean that, but that's what it sounds like. Now, very, very occasionally, we do have not the autograph copy, but we do have, particularly from Roman Egypt, we have very, very early papyri, maybe from the 1st century CE, 1st century BCE, where there are early copies of this. Otherwise, the whole of our understanding of classical texts, what Suetonius wrote, what Virgil wrote, or any of these guys wrote, and it is almost all guys, we do it through looking at the copies made by monks, sometimes not very attentively, in medieval monasteries where they're sitting out and kind of copying out the great works of classical literature, making terrible errors. Then somebody in the monastery down the road is doing the same. And the texts that we have attempt to iron out your errors that you talk about, but do it only by painstaking comparison between one version and another. And we still remain, you know, I've talked about, look, we remain a bit distant from any image of Julius Caesar. We also remain quite a bit distant from anything that Suetonius ever wrote, actually, or Virgil ever wrote. It is a reconstruction. Now, classicists obscure that reconstruction by saying, oh, yes, we have the lives of Suetonius. We don't have them. We have reinvented them. I hope quite accurately, but not. There are some bits, well, we don't know.
Keeps you in the job, perhaps.
I have to say, it's a bit above my pay grade. Interestingly, I'm going to use this shorthand now. We don't now have the beginning of Suetonius's lives. So we've got the lives of the 12 Caesars, apart from, because of manuscript, the way the manuscripts have been lost, we don't have his introduction. So we don't know how he introduced Julius Caesar. And it's quite interesting because Suetonius starts his lives with Julius Caesar. Most people now would not say Caesar was the first emperor. They'd say he was the last of the Republicans. Suetonius made him the first emperor, but we've got no idea whether he justified that at the beginning. So there's great gaps, and there's guesswork.
I think we've got time for one last question, please. Thank you.
Oh my God, I'm the last question. the pressure. Okay.
Yes, no pressure.
That's right. Well, I'm delighted to see you here in person. My older brother wants to name all of his children after ancient Romans. And I was just wondering what you think of that, because since his two children, Octavia and Quintus, have entered the world, I've begun seeing ancient Roman names all over the place, like on name tags at Trader Joe's. And so I was in Chicago at the Trader Joe's, and I saw that the clerk's name was Nero, and I had a conversation with him about that. But anyway, I'm just wondering, what have you noticed this, and are there any names that you approve of or disapprove of? Why not?
I think I'd give your brother one piece of advice, which is be very, very careful if you choose a Roman emperor, right? I think that Quintus is quite safe, means the fifth, I don't know. Octavia, female. You know, I would steer clear of Nero, Caligula, Domitian, that almost every Roman emperor, even the ones that look good, a little digging is going to reveal things that you might not want. So try sticking to poets. I think that would be...
It's much safer. So I think this is... I think we're at a stop here, probably. And again, join me, please, in thanking Mary for coming here.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.